From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is the ER. A year ago this month, a Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, was a wake-up call for many Americans. It was a sign that white supremacist groups are a fixture in the political landscape of this country. Some of these groups have been around for decades. Neo-Nazis, skinheads, and of course, the Ku Klux Klan.
A Klan bomb ripped apart Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church, killing four children attending Bible class.
But the election of Donald Trump in 2016 and what many saw as his reluctance to denounce these groups outright has given them a new sense of legitimacy.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides.
Our guest this week is Vegas Tenold, a journalist who spent 6 years embedded with white supremacist groups, interviewing their members, attending their meetings, covering their rallies. His book about the experience, Everything You Love Will Burn, came out earlier this year. Tenold is from Norway. It's a country which has seen its own share of white supremacist violence. Welcome, Vegas. I want to start by asking you how you got into all this.
In my defense, I never decided to spend 6 years. It kind of just happened by accident because what else was I going to do with my time? My first sort of intro to this was I did a postgraduate degree in journalism at Columbia, and I needed something to write about. And I've always been a little fascinated by the fringe and by the bizarre and the little hopeless. So when I read somewhere, I was just Googling around, I guess, that there were neo-Nazis in Brooklyn, I thought that was, well, that's fascinating. I decided to look into it. I didn't see them as any part of a large movement or anything like that. I mean, we were talking about the Tea Party at that time being pretty much the most extreme thing we had here in America. But I thought these guys were interesting more for their sort of weirdness and anachronistic nature than anything else. I thought, you know, who the hell still subscribes to this garbage in 2011? So I tried to seek them out. I wasn't having much luck. I emailed a bunch of addresses and I left messages at a bunch of forums. But I didn't hear back until I think 2 or 3 months later when all of a sudden an email from a guy called Duke Schneider, who introduced himself as the captain of the SS Brooklyn Division, emails me and says, you know, do you want to talk?
Vegas, when you started looking into this, were you focused only on neo-Nazis, white supremacists now? Or had you fallen down sort of a historical rabbit hole, reading everything about Nazis in America from the 30s to the 70s to the present?
I did. I mean, it changed for me over time. I mean, at first, I really just wanted to do a story about these weirdos in Brooklyn, and I went with them to a rally in Trenton, New Jersey, and that my plan was to have that be it. But the more I wrote about it, and the more I thought about it, the more interested I become looking at this in a historical perspective and trying to put it into a larger context. And you know, another thing that happened was, after I'd done this initial story and I kind of closed the door on it a little bit, I went back to Norway for the summer of 2011, which, of course, was when Anders Behring Breivik, the white supremacist terrorist, took it upon himself to massacre 77 of our best and brightest. And for me, and, you know, I think maybe I was, like many others, I was naive about the dangers posed by the far right at that point. But it really brought home the threat and the inherent violence in this political ideology. So I did want to go further. And that's when I went back to America and I really sort of dove headfirst into this rabbit hole of white supremacy.
So you go to this first meeting. What happens?
So I first met Duke Schneider at a deli in downtown Manhattan, and we talked. And he was he was a little bit of how I always imagined a Nazi would look. He was this sort of plug of a man. He came in wearing this wolf tank top and he was shaved head. He's in his mid-60s, I would say. But he was kind of friendly enough, and I explained that I was interested in, you know, not just writing about the politics, but also exploring the kind of people he hung out with and the kind of people he that belonged to his groups. So we started meeting. We would invariably meet in Sheepshead Bay, and it was kind of funny. He was extremely paranoid. They all were back then. I mean, these days, it's relatively easy to gain access to this group, these groups, because they've come to depend on the media for exposure. But back then, it wasn't so easy. So I had to meet this guy a bunch of times. We would always go. I would get on the subway. I would get to Avenue U Station in Sheepshead Bay. And he would be there under an overpass, sort of in the shadows. There were times he would even wear like a trench coat, like a very short, very fat, deep throat, kind of lurking in the shadows in this trench coat. And we'd get into his Hyundai, and you know, we'd crisscross the neighborhood a few times, and always end up in the same diner, you know, five blocks down the street. But he said that's because the CIA was after him, or the NSA, or the FBI, or the ADL, or the SPLC, or all these just sort of abbreviations that he would throw at me endlessly. But I had a bunch of these meetings with him. We would have coffee and cake. Sometimes he brought his daughter and we would talk. And then eventually I was told that I'd been invited to come to their annual convention. Of course, there would be no telephones and no notebooks, and I wasn't told where we were going. So, you know, this one day in April, I showed up down there without any idea where we were going, and I got in the car with them, and we went to New Jersey, and they had this big rally, and they were attacked by Antifa, and that was my first real exposure to neo-Nazis in America.
So it sounds like you won their trust. How did that happen?
Well, I think, you know, I had the luxury of just being able to spend a lot of time talking to them first. I was a student journalist. I had no real deadlines. I had no editors waiting for me. So I was able to just sit and explain who I was. I was extremely open with who I was and what my personal beliefs were. But I said, you know, listen, I'm not out to get you guys. I'm legitimately interested in why you guys feel it's important to believe the things you believe and to fight for the things you want to fight. So, you know, I was constantly pushing back, but I think I was legitimately interested in what they had to say.
What were these meetings like? What kinds of things were they saying?
I mean, it's different from what it is today, and it's also the same, of course. I mean, this being 2011, there was a lot of anti-Obama rhetoric and a lot of sort of slurs. And I feel like, you know, they were very much fighting or rallying back then to try to take back something that they believed they had lost. Whereas after Trump got elected, they felt very much like they were coming at it from a position of power more. So that was different. But other than that, you know, the song and dance of these rallies are much the same as they are today. They show up, they have a big police presence, a police cordon, Antifa are there, they're being kept a couple of blocks away, and there's just sort of shouting going over the police lines a lot. The rally itself, I mean, or the meeting itself was surprisingly, you know, almost pleasant. These people see each other once a year, so they just kind of got together and talked and reminisced, weirdly wearing replica Third Reich Nazi uniforms. So it was a very bizarre disconnect between all this super hateful, gross and abhorrent imagery and certainly things they were talking about, but also, you know, how's your grandma? How's work? I haven't seen you. It's nice to see your family. Let me see pictures. So it was for someone who'd never seen anything like it before, it was a pretty bizarre experience.
So that's your first rally. You're still in school. You continue to follow them. What happens next?
Well, then I decided to start going further into this and looking further into what constituted the movement of white supremacy in America. And it got easier. Having spent, there's a little bit of overlap with these groups, not much, but everyone kind of knows the other. So I decided to reach out to a KKK group after that. And it was easier because I'd been able to say, look, I spent time with the National Socialist Movement. I think they found that I was fair. Will you guys let me come and just sort of spend some time with you guys? So I did that, and I went to this Klan rally in North Carolina, which was just sort of an innocuous Klan rally, if there's such a thing. They had a cross sledding. We ate awful barbecue. I think they served possum or something. But there I met some skinheads from the so-called Blood and Honor movement, and I started talking to them, and I got invited to another thing. So it just sort of snowballed a little bit, I guess, until I was sort of, I had a wide network of contacts in the larger movement.
Can you explain cross-lighting, what that means, and if you can explain that for us?
Yeah, one of the mistakes that it's easy to make when you first start covering the Klan, and it is a mistake that they find wholly offensive, is when you ask them, so when are you going to burn this cross or something to that effect? And they get very angry and they take it very personally because to them, they're not burning the cross, they're lighting the cross. It's a symbol of the light of Christ in the darkness. But, you know, it's almost weird to have gotten used to these things. I've been to, I don't know how many cross lightings I've been to, but they are, you know, the Klan is a bumbling bunch of fools who have very little relevance today in America. But once you see them put on those robes and you see that cross start burning in the darkness, it is terrifying because, you know, they are this symbol of hatred. They're the, you know, they're the preeminent symbol of racism and white supremacy and hatred in this country. So no matter how many times you see it, it's scary and it's really disturbing.
When you say they thought you were fair, what does that mean exactly? What's balance in this context?
I think it's a little bit of both. And obviously, a lot of these people aren't going to think you're fair regardless. But I told them straight up that, you know, I'm going to write what I hear and what I see. I'm not going to make up stuff. If you guys come across like idiots or if you feel like it's, you guys are coming off bad, it's because of what you said and what you did. I'm going to push back, but I'm genuinely interested in hearing what you say and having a discussion about it. So, you know, what I wrote, I think they found it. I don't want to say balanced, but they recognized themselves in what I wrote. I think they didn't all love it, but you know, at least some of them were adult enough to recognize that this is what they said. They're going to have to stand by it.
Did you come to like them in some way? Is it inevitable to care a little bit about these subjects you spend so much time with?
These guys, no. Eventually, I met who would become the man who become the main subject of my book, Matthew Heimbach. I actually met him first at that Klan rally, but we didn't speak for a couple of years after that. And it took us a while to remember that we'd actually met. Matthew Heimbach was a different breed, I would say. He was, the media liked him because he was personable. He was affable. He was well-spoken. He could be counted on to say outrageous things in a sort of friendly way. So he was always a good interview. But you know, he would talk a lot about that we need to take white supremacy out of white nationalism. My race isn't better than anyone else. It just so happens to be my race. Whether or not that was true, I don't know. But he was interesting and sometimes even enjoyable to talk to. So I wouldn't say I became friendly with him either, but we had a different discourse than I did with, you know, your everyday Klansman or neo-Nazi.
It sounds like they became increasingly comfortable with you, but was there any moment, any rally or meeting where you felt particularly unsafe yourself?
Yeah, sure. There were a couple of times. There were some threats. I had a few guns pointed at me for various reasons. But, I mean, look, I was always very open with who I was, right? So I didn't want it to be a surprise to anyone that there was a journalist there. So most of the people there knew who I was, and they really didn't have that much of a reason to be offended that I was there. The few times I got in a little bit of trouble is because there had been a misunderstanding. Someone had been told who I was or why I was there. And also, look, I'm a white, bald man. I'm very low on their list of targets and enemies. I have female journalist friends who are journalists who cover this beat. I have Jewish friends. I have African-American friends who cover this beat who are, you know, their risk calculation is way beyond what mine was. So, no, I always felt pretty okay in these circumstances.
So you're saying someone actually pulled a gun on you. Was it because he thought you were some sort of interloper, a journalist? What happened?
Yeah, there was this guy. We were going to a Klan rally in Tennessee, I believe it was. And my source within this group was a guy called Dan Elmquist, and he was the guy who had invited me to this. It was a Klan funeral, and just before we went out there that day, he was called away. He had to do something else. So going out there was just me, Matthew Heimbach, who is a Russian Orthodox National Socialist and a fascist, who, you know, there's very little love lost between anyone who isn't a Protestant and the Klan, and this skinhead called Eric. So they didn't know us at all. And when we showed up there, there was no one there except this one big guy who comes over and he gives me, at the time, I didn't know he gave me a Klan greeting. He said, Kiggy. And I said, well, it's nice to meet you, Kiggy. I'm Vegas. And it turns out he'd said Kiggy, which is short for Klansman, I greet you. And you're supposed to give him a secret handshake. And you're supposed to say Akia, which means a Klansman I am. I'm spilling a lot of Klan secrets here in this podcast, but I'm sure they'll be okay. So when I got that wrong, he became immediately suspicious. And then I started, you know, saying I'm a journalist and yada, yada, yada. And he'd been drinking all day, I think, and he didn't want me there and he didn't feel comfortable. So I just remember him putting his hand around my shoulder and sort of pulling me close. And for a second, I thought I was going to get a hug, which was scary enough on its own. But then he reaches back into his waistband and he brings out this filthy old 9mm gun and he just kind of holds it under my chin, pushes it sort of up into my chin. And he says, you know, I've killed a lot more people than I've been to prison for, and I've been to prison for killing people, you know, which is no doubt hyperbole, but it was a little bit scary at the time. It was over in a matter of a couple of minutes, I think. But, you know, these things happen when you deal with these kinds of people.
So you're among them all the time. Does it tweak your own political views at all? Do you start to question your own place?
I think if anything, it reaffirms and strengthens your own politics, because you're always, you know, as they began to know me and we would talk more, we would start having, you know, franker and franker discussions. And I felt more comfortable to push back even harder. And, you know, we got into shouting matches. And so, you know, once if you're confronted by this all the time, then it really makes you reassess your politics, and it makes you think about what it is about socialism and the notion of equality and that you'd like and that you appreciate. And, you know, it becomes a point of pride to defend it. And I think white supremacy and nationalism isn't an ideology that becomes, you know, more incisive the deeper you dig into it. I mean, the flaws just become more apparent. To me, white supremacy only works if you don't question it at all, and it hardly works then. So, no, absolutely not. I was never, there was never any risk of me going native, so to speak.
But in an excerpt of your book that ran in The Guardian, you noted that you'd never asked this main character his views on the Holocaust.
I mean, yeah, and that was a thing as well. As I mentioned, Matthew Heimbach was at times fun and pleasant to talk about. And I noticed after a while that, you know, between talking to skinheads and talking to Klans people and just straight up white supremacists, it becomes exhausting because there are only so many slurs and conspiracies and just noxious things you can hear until you just want to shut down. So after a while, I realized that, you know, am I taking a break when I'm with Matthew? Like, we're talking about Toto and we're talking about Dungeons and Dragons and Warhammer. And am I sort of using him as a respite almost between all this noxious stuff? And I thought for a second that, yeah, maybe I've become complacent. Maybe just because he is an affable person, I'm not pushing back as hard as I should, or I'm not being as critical as I should. And I think that's a risk journalists run. And you know, I wanted to be open about that. I wanted to be open about my own failings in this respect, and that it's something, I had something of a wake-up call, and I think that's important.
You mentioned that before Trump, there things were kind of in the shadows, that these white supremacists were having you meet under underpasses and zigging and zagging around to go to the same diner, and there was a fear of the CIA. What changed after the Trump election?
I think it changed well ahead of the Trump election. I mean, a lot of what changed as well is attention. We weren't paying attention to these people. They were always there, which is one of the things I find infuriating by the use of the term alt-right, because it implies that, you know, Richard Spencer and all these people came out of the woodwork and had this whole brand new thing, and it really wasn't. It's just the same old thing that white nationalists and white supremacists have been saying forever. But I think something changed with the candidacy of Donald Trump, obviously. And one of the things that changed was that we started paying attention. But they did really feel all of a sudden like they had a voice. And it wasn't like that. I mean, I remember I went to the CPAC convention in 2015, I believe. And I was there, and Matthew Heimbach had snuck in with me because he wanted to heckle Rick Santorum. And we happened upon a speech by Donald Trump in the main hall. And by that point, he was a sideshow. Everyone was just there to see the coronation of Jeb Bush. But we were sitting there, and Donald Trump was talking, and Matthew Heimbach, who at that point was a large figure on the far right, he was just laughing, like, look at this idiot. You know, he's a joke. He's never going to become anything. And then all of a sudden, he wasn't. And I think he recognized that the far right in the country and even parts of the Tea Party had ideas that resonated. And I think they noticed that he was picking up on their ideas as well. So I think it was sort of a symbiosis. The two things fed on each other, and the more they fed, the more the far right gained a sense of hubris. They felt like they had a seat at the table. So Donald Trump didn't create this in any way. He is just sort of the product of it, if you will.
You're from Norway. How similar are American white supremacists to European far right groups you spent time with?
It's the same, I would say. I mean, this rise of far-right populism isn't an American thing. It is a Western thing at the moment. You see the same sentiment all over. You know, in Europe, they're not afraid of Mexicans. They're afraid of Syrians. And in other parts of Europe, they're not afraid of Syrians. They're afraid of Eastern Europeans. So I think there's this sense of fear that is sweeping across Western country these days, and it's being fed by politicians, by populists. So you know, it becomes this loop where politicians feed it, and the movements they feed elect new politicians. So right now, we're in this really scary point in history where, for some reason, and you know, I don't want to downplay the seriousness of the Syrian immigration crisis, but it is an immigration that Europe is well equipped to handle. But for some reason, the rhetoric is that this is too much for us. This is something we need to fear. This is something that's gonna take over our countries from within. And it's the same rhetoric as you have here with Muslims or with Mexicans or with whatever. So it's not a European phenomenon. It's not an American phenomenon. It is a Western phenomenon. It's slightly different in Europe because there are predominantly parliamentarian systems, so the dynamic is a little bit different. But the sentiment and the what causes it, I think, is very much the same.
So often in the American media, it sounded like Charlottesville came out of nowhere. But you seem to be saying that that's actually not true at all.
I think the media has become a lot better in the last year or so of putting this into a larger framework and a larger context. And, you know, I'm not the only guy who sort of saw this coming. I wasn't some lone voice in the dark warning against Nazis. There were a ton of journalists and others who did this before me. But, you know, there was a time when there would be a neo-Nazi rally somewhere in America and all these journalists was kind of parachute in and then just write about Nazis in the street. And that would be it. They wouldn't, you know, place it into a larger context. You know, the same group were here last year. They were larger last year, or they were smaller last year. What does that say? Or how have we heard this rhetoric before? And you know, even though we're getting better, we're seeing a little bit of the same thing today when people are writing about and talking about the spectacular failure of the Unite the Right 2 rally yesterday, and treating that as a symptom of the relative health of the far right movement, whereas it isn't. It's just a symptom of how despised Jason Kessler is in the movement. It has no bearing on the general health of the movement overall. But I think we're getting better at contextualizing and seeing the larger picture. There's still a ways to go, but I think we're getting a lot better.
But do you think spending a lot of time reporting on white supremacists, on these rallies, on the neo-Nazis, do we risk elevating their stature? Do we give them too much airtime and, you know, make it seem like their numbers are larger than they are?
I get that argument, and it's something that I've wrestled with. Mm-hmm. I think the way we address that as well is with, again, placing it into context and being critical. When it comes to platforming, and another term that gets thrown around is normalizing. You don't platform necessarily by writing about something. You platform something if you just give it an unobstructed access to your platform. You know, we got to cover it. We just got to make sure that we tell the whole story.
One question that you've addressed a bit is the funding of these groups. Where is it coming from? And is it all domestic or is it also international?
There's a lot of head scratching about this. And you know, I honestly don't know the whole story about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some groups, I'm sure, who are getting funding from elsewhere. The groups I've covered mainly, I haven't seen much money at all. Like, they stay five people to a hotel room, and whatever money they have, it's certainly not much. There are all these rumors that Russia is donating to the cause. And you'll hear sometimes people say, like, oh, no, I have proof that Putin is giving material aid. I haven't seen it. I don't think any of my colleagues have seen evidence of any material aid. I once you know, had a secret meeting with a Russian who was supposed to give them money, but I don't think anything came of that. There's been examples of Russia helping out European groups. There have been, through various banks and intermediaries, money going from Russia to Marine Le Pen's Front National in France. But here in America, not so much. I mean, I'm sure there are some groups who have sugar daddies. You know, Richard Spencer is a rich guy. But I really don't know, and I don't think anyone does.
There are a handful of candidates running for various sort of relatively local office or Congress who have espoused white supremacist-sounding ideologies. I mean, there are only a couple. There was one in California. There was one someplace else. Do you think we'll see more, or are you surprised by that? Is that something that you were expecting to see, that there's sort of actually joining the political ranks rather than fighting it and being quite transparent about the platform?
So that's the thing. When people say that the alt-right is dead or that the far-right movement in America is dying, as a lot of people have been talking about this spring, my friend Ryan Lentz, who used to be at the SPLC, talks a lot about, and he makes a great point when he says that the far-right movement wasn't the end in itself. The far-right movement is a vehicle by which to introduce far-right ideology and ideas into the mainstream, right? So the relative size of a rally isn't the point. The point is now we have these candidates all over America, and some of them are doing quite well. I mean, Steve West just beat out two challengers in the GOP primaries in Missouri. So the real threat of the far right is that they have made it palatable. They have ensured that these ideas, these anti-Semitic ideas, these anti-Black ideas, these anti-LGBTQ ideas are no longer a third rail in politics. You can touch them now, and it's okay.
And do you think that, I mean, we've talked about this, the identitarians and keeping out migrants, and obviously it's not talking about Latin America, it's more talking about Syria and the migration, the kind of great waves of migration that have come since 2015 from North Africa and across the Middle East. Are they being advanced in the same tones, the same racist tones, the same xenophobic tones? Are they same? Are they quite as clear on the sort of idea of white supremacy?
So when Trump, you know, back in the good old days when we were still outraged by this stuff, when he referred to Mexican immigrants as rapists, right? Mm-hmm. All over Europe now, and in America as well, you'll hear talk of rapefugees, which are hordes of young, strong men running away in cowardice from Syria and from North Africa to come up and take advantage of beautiful white women and children. That's the narrative they like to tell. So it's absolutely the same. I mean, I would even say it's more vitriolic in Europe, because not only do they look different and talk different, they're also, you know, Muslims. So you have like this trifecta of propaganda value to spout when you're trying to recruit and when you're talking about this thing. So the level of discourse in Europe, I think, is even uglier than it is over here.
Well, Vegas, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about your years embedded. Maybe we'll have you back soon.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I hope so.
That was journalist Vegas Tenold. His book on his experience with white supremacists in the United States is called Everything You Love Will Burn. You've been listening to The ER. Our show is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs. We're taking a short end of summer break, but we'll be back with a new episode on September 7th.